Hello and welcome to Clinical Realities, a podcast mini-series from The Lancet Rheumatology, where we explore the realities of rheumatology care and research in challenging settings and amongst underserved and neglected patient populations across the globe. My name is Pooja Mehta. I'm a rheumatology trainee undertaking research in interstitial lung disease at UCL in London. It's a pleasure to join the Lancet Rheumatology team to host the Clinical Realities series. And in today's episode, we'll explore the importance and challenges of transition services as children with rheumatological conditions move from children to adult services as they grow up. There are many rheumatologists who practice in this space, and I'm very lucky to be joined by two of them today. Dr. Kosiana Chertin, a consultant adolescent and adult rheumatologist from University College London Healthcare NHS Trust, and Dr. Kate Webb, CRIC African Network Research Fellow and consultant paediatric rheumatologist from the University of Cape Town and the Francis Crick Institute. Welcome to you both, and thank you so much for joining me to talk about this very important topic. So let's get cracking. Could you first briefly describe the settings in which you work? Could we start with you, Kosiana?
Hi, Pooja. I would like to thank you first for the generous introduction and for creating this opportunity to discuss about transition. This is a subject close to my heart and also the core of my daily clinical practice. I'm currently working in a large university hospital, and we have a dedicated adolescent and young adult rheumatology service. And I personally am looking after patients age 13 to 24 and also older. I'm an adult rheumatologist by training, and in 2018, I could not resist the pull of a career opportunity change, which created for me the premise for additional clinical training and academic research in the field of adolescent rheumatology.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And Kate, could you tell us how it compares, the clinic in South Africa, to UCLH?
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for having me on. As you said, I'm a paediatric rheumatologist and a researcher. And I trained in South Africa, in Cape Town specifically, and then I had the privilege to go to UCL to perform some research there for my PhD, and I've come back to South Africa now. So I have a nice perspective on both settings that sometimes I think can open your eyes. I work in Cape Town at the moment. About a third of our population is under the age of 20. So we are a relatively undersourced area when we're looking at rheumatology services. Between UCT, which is one of the big universities in the city, we have an adult and pediatric service. And between the three of them, there's three full-time employed rheumatologists, one pediatric rheumatologist and two adult rheumatologists. We had quite a good transition or adolescent clinic, as we like to call it, at the adult hospital, which is a separate site, where we would have our patients when they were sort of transitioning, and we would send them over to the adolescent clinic where they'd slowly get to know the adult doctors. But unfortunately, with COVID, all of the adolescent services at the adult clinic were diverted to COVID services, and all of our adolescents and young people have moved back to the pediatric hospital. So we're in a bit of a tough position at the moment where we don't have dedicated adolescent clinics that integrate with adult services.
Yeah, look forward to getting into this, but let's start perhaps with setting the scene and definitions. So what exactly is transitional care and why is it so important? So perhaps, Kosiana, we could start with your perspective.
Importantly, it's a process, it's not an event, it takes place during a pivotal time in the development of a young person. I would say that it's multifaceted just because it involves many, many aspects, and I like to think about it as being very active because it should be backed up by a dynamic understanding of the changes that accompany the development of the young person. We need to attend to various aspects of their care, in particular their medical, psychosocial, educational, vocational, social needs of adolescents, and the key is that we help them move from child to adult-centered care.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And Kate, would you have anything to add to that?
I really like Kosiana's definition where she's included looking at it rather as a process than a one-off. And I know that there are, there's various phases to transition and transitional care, which take into account preparation, take into account the actual transition. And then I think the post-transition care, which is probably underserved and also really important, looking even at going into young adulthood. So, as young adults equally aren't the same as older adults. And there's a whole bunch of skills that kids need to acquire that we can speak about. And I also like how you place it in the context of of who an adolescent or a young person is, that their social development, their vocational development, these are kids in school, and their kind of psychosocial and neurological development at this stage is different. So that's, you know, we really have to place the definition of transition, as you say, as a process, but also in the context of how young people function, what skills they may acquire, how their brains function differently. And really, I think it should almost be defined, including young people's point of view and the active involvement of them.
Thank you. And just building from that, in terms of the aims, the World Health Organization and UN have outlined some aims, but do you have any specific aims relevant to the populations that you serve? And so perhaps we could start with you, Kate.
Well, just in like an entirely personal point of view, you know, one of the things that worries me the most about our lack of transition and how poorly we're currently doing transition is safety. So, you know, one of the worst outcomes that I've noticed is a loss to follow up, is poor adherence, and is flares during this time. So, you know, my main aim in trying to better our transition services would just to be ensure safety, to ensure some continuity of care, and to give these kids or young people a safe environment where there are backups and plans and people that they can contact should they need to. So I think our main aim would be to improve patient safety, improve the safety across the transition, but also to give these young people a kind of whole young person experience, as you say, Kosiana, where we support them in the many facets of their life, which contribute to how difficult transition can be. What would your thoughts be on that,
Kosiana? No, I fully agree, Kate, with you. And I like to think about it as being a process that we're involved in and shaping the life of our patients. We have many transitions in life, and the transition to adulthood is considered to be one of the most important one because it has far-reaching consequences for every single individual. That's why, for me, transition is more than getting it right from the medical point of view. I'm particularly passionate about promoting people's skills in communication, decision-making, in assertiveness, something that can help them build up their skills for self-care, self-determination, self-advocacy. These are things that are really, really important, and we play as healthcare professionals an important role in. Giving a young person the sense of control, independence, and also providing support for their family, for their parents, for their guardians, very important during this process, because in the end we are at that place that we can maximize the lifelong functioning and potential of an individual. That's why I feel that our involvement should be a little bit more pastoral and a little bit more kind of extended than the limited role of a clinician getting the medical transfer right. And I have another thing that is a specific aim for my own kind of a practice. I noticed, probably more since COVID, that the transition process has a kind of a non-linearity that maybe we never took into account when we mapped this process. And it's probably focusing on the biopsychosocial development rather than chronological age of our patients. But what I observed, that I had young people that I transferred to the young adult services, and I met them after the transition process was going into the third phase. And because somehow the COVID caused them a setback, I found them being unable to function very well in an adult care system. That's why I had to revisit some of the processes and some of the things that I've been through with them together to try to offer them that support that was considered to be probably less relevant for their chronological age and this third phase of transition.
What's very interesting is that transition services are so highly variable in different parts of the world. And in some parts of the world, people continue to see their pediatricians, even though they're grown up. And in others, there's a very sharp, quick move to adult services without this sort of buffer period in between. And perception of adolescent services is sometimes seen as a luxury, a nice to have, an additional extra, rather than a mandatory essential that's really important. And something that you said earlier about this is a critical time of development, and patients' identity may be changed by their chronic illness, and the way that they look at themselves and the world, it can be affected. If we get it wrong at that stage, what do you think can happen later on in life? And do you think it may affect healthcare utilization behaviours? So perhaps, Kate, if we could start with you. perception of adolescent services and what happens if we don't get it right.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you that there is a perception that an adolescent service is a luxury. And it's just simply not true. I mean, Kosiana and I both focus on adolescents in our research. And, you know, in research, adolescents are a really underrepresented group because they're so variable, because so many things are happening. They're quite hard to research because they don't all look the same. And similar to that, adolescents really fall through the gaps when it comes to clinical care because no one's quite sure where they belong. Everyone treats them a bit differently. And they are all so different. So they're not an easy group, and they really do deserve their own care because it's such a time for potential trouble. I think there's also a real difference in pediatricians and adult rheumatologists. We all have the same aim, but I think we approach things quite differently. And what's really nice about adolescent or transition care is how we can start to kind of understand each other a bit more. I know that, you know, pediatricians, very often we cling quite a lot for quite a long time, and we have a very paternalistic approach where we really take care of every facet of the patient, including, you know, things like making appointments, including making sure that if they don't come to appointments, we follow them up. And we almost aren't doing them a service because we're not teaching them those really important skills, like advocating for their own health, you know, slowly teaching them how to reschedule an MRI if they've forgotten it, who to call, you know, how do things look. Those are all massive skills in terms of how you go forward, what happens when your prescription's expired. And I think in places that are under-resourced, that's even more important. So, yeah, I think adolescent obviously is such an important thing to do, to have a service or even a transitional service. And I think it doesn't matter if they're different across places, and they have to be quite specific for each center and perhaps based on the needs of what we think kids and young people want.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the potential knock-on effects later on to adult services and the healthcare resources locally, nationally, internationally are not insignificant. Kosiana, would you have anything to add with respect to long-term impact?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in a way, both Kate and I are placed in a privileged situation that we understood the need for creating these services, and we operate within a service that has reasonably good support from the hospitals and also expertise that has been built through various collaborations and interdisciplinary approaches. Looking at some of the hard data, we know that there are different in different parts of the world, and I was quite surprised to hear that only probably one in two rheumatologists in America are comfortable to discuss transition or look after patients at this age, and even less than that, maybe one in four of the general medicine practitioners are competent in performing any of the core transition skills, which is really, really interesting. And we do not have probably policies in more than one in three centers in Europe. There is research showing that young people age 18 to 25 overall across all diseases have worse health status than the ones younger and the ones older than them, which shows that this is an extremely vulnerable period in their life that we need to address with adequate support. We know that, unfortunately, post-transfer, both morbidity, mortality increases in these young people. And also from rheumatology, we know very well that one in two is an absolutely high number of GIA patients, of patients with adolescent rheumatic conditions, are lost to care at the time of transfer, which is something that is extremely, extremely relevant. That's why, for me, why I think it's not a luxury, not at all, because getting it wrong now, if the transition is forced at the time when a young person is ill prepared, that's likely to be associated with perceived lack of control from them, and choices they will make for their future health and life are very much impacted by this. That's why I think that the way they go into utilizing the healthcare services and also their attitudes towards health are likely to be significantly influenced by the way they transition and the continuity of care we offer them.
Thank you. Let's move to barriers. What do you think the main barriers are to providing effective transition care? I mean, I've heard of kids being described as clingy, so I was fascinated, Kate, when you said pediatricians could be clingy. What do you think the other barriers are, and how can we overcome them?
Well, you know, in our context at the moment, in an under-resourced setting where I think COVID has had a huge impact, we really do struggle with many barriers. And, you know, I think our services are under-resourced as they stand. So, you know, making people aware of the importance of transition and funding transition for us is one of our main barriers. But we can still do a lot without a dedicated transition clinic. So I think the biggest barrier is lack of communication between adults and pediatric services. I think if you have a good communication platform set up, even with minimal resources, you can do a lot. And really perception, and kind of educating both teams about it being important. So even if your transition process is super limited, a really good discharge summary and an ongoing conversation is better than not having those things. So, you know, I for me, the barriers are lack of communication and lack of resources and lack of importance are really important. But I think that they really do vary in various settings.
Thank you. And Kosiana, barriers to clinical care, but also to research.
We do have some barriers related probably with the poor integration of transitional care services overall, because we deal with patients that are quite complex and we need to manage them in a way that involves a lot of multidisciplinary assessments. Sometimes we are still not quite there in meeting the patient and caregivers' needs. And this is not easy always to pinpoint, because we need that time dedicated to the consultation to be able to explore not only the priorities of our patients, but also their social network, their support, their family needs, and also again to be able to revisit that, to go back to all these things that we assessed because of the dynamic process of transition through life of a young person. Sometimes we have underutilized services. Talking to my colleagues at UCLH, there are probably psychologists that could be involved more in the transition, and I must admit sometimes there is a lack of physician engagement. Not everybody understands in every single specialty, depending on the conditions you are dealing with, and particularly some of our colleagues who are not dealing with chronic conditions, how important it is to have at the other end the physician engaging to take over a young person's care.
And do you know of any national or international strategies to help address these issues that you've discussed?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the UK, we have this "you are welcome" quality criteria for everything that is a youth-friendly health service, which in a way is really, really good, because they are supposed to kind of encompass those qualities that we need to be able to provide through the services across all specialties, which I quite like, this kind of a way of generalizing the priorities that we need to be focused on. And it's all about accessibility. Whatever we do has to be focused on young people. We need to talk about health issues that are relevant to them. And of course, sexual, reproductive health, mental health are integral part of whatever we are supposed to deliver. And also it's important for us as clinicians, as health professionals, to be trained, to have the skills, the attitudes, the values that kind of match what we want to achieve in nurturing young people. And not the last is very important to monitor and evaluate what we are doing to give us the possibility to improve it. That means, yes, we have criteria. They are present all over, and maybe we should open up whatever we are doing to as many stakeholders as possible and involve them from charities, from families, from improved education to support what we are doing. And I think many of these criteria that exist in the UK or across the world, some of them are endorsed by the World Health Organization, can be adapted and maybe should be adapted to every single clinical reality in various countries.
Yeah, so we've got a slightly different, because we don't have a specifically rheumatology-focused transition clinic. What we are trying to do locally, and what the local kind of health authorities are trying to do, is set up an adolescent service that's multi-platform, which I think in our context is quite an interesting and maybe effective way to do it. So, you know, a baseline adolescent service that would provide mental health care for adolescents, provide a safe space to get in terms of a family planning and that kind of care, and a safe space in our context to access things like TB and HIV drugs once you become an adolescent. So, you know, using those more common diseases in our context or more common needs to set up a platform that eventually, hopefully, we could build, you know, a once-a-week rheumatology clinic where an adult and a pediatric rheumatologist went to the specific adolescent service, you know. So I think, you know, it's important to be creative in the strategies, where we may never have, or may hopefully one day have, enough capacity in rheumatology specifically to set up good transition. But perhaps rather than focus on rheumatology, focus on, you know, an adolescent service that could support subspecialties in different disciplines, but at its base provides good support for young people and young adults in a holistic manner moving forward. So, you know, that's one of the strategies that I think we've got going forward, and that might be quite unique in terms of how things work and not be specialty-based, and might be a model that we can analyze in the future. But at the moment, we're not measuring outcomes specifically for young people, which is also one of the things we have to do in order to motivate for these services going forward.
No, absolutely. I think we've talked a lot about why transition care is important, what we can do to try and make it better. But in order to measure whether we are making improvements, it's important to report outcomes. So with respect to your research, what are your specific areas and what do you think the difficulties are in the field that you've chosen?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, definitely the way we try to capture outcome measures is related to many of our research projects. And what we have noticed by collaborating with various researchers nationally and internationally is that we have a lack of continuity of collecting this data across age. As we know very well, we have very, very good registries looking at patients with different diseases, especially on biologic treatment. But unfortunately, they are very much separated between the pediatric and the adult care. And there is no continuity, there is no registry that integrates this data across age. What I'm really more interested beyond all these outcome measures that are very much disease specific or disease related are the ones that are related to other outcomes important to young people, such as mental health, social integration, social inclusion, things that are not very easy to capture. And if I think in how much transition process should involve a young person in a decision-making process and to promote the personal development, the self-esteem or other things that we are interested in, I find this very difficult to translate in outcome measures.
Perhaps I could speak about a more kind of specific research that I've been doing and the challenges. So, you know, I was privileged to work at a Center for Adolescent Rheumatology where Kosiana is, which is an enormously resourced and amazing place to be able to work because you have access to so much support and you have access to a real focus on adolescence. But in other places, like where I am working on lupus, which is perceived as rare compared to other diseases like infectious diseases, and working in a population such as adolescents, so young people with lupus, where it's perceived to be not such a big problem as in adults, really does bring the challenges of really having to advocate for the research. But, you know, I think it's a fascinating population, as you say, Kosiana, and a fascinating research question, because we know that people with juvenile onset lupus have much more severe disease in the long term, are more likely to have end organ or severe lupus as defined by things like renal nephritis and CNS disease. And we know from our data that in our population, perhaps because of referral biases, our kids tend to present only once they've had a stroke or once they're in renal failure. So we have a really severe disease phenotype. So those challenges also come with, you know, the advantage of having an amazing group of patients who deserve to be studied and have some really valuable insights to give to the world, I think. And we have good communication to follow them up going forward. So, you know, I think that research in adolescents and underserved populations like this comes with a burden of advocating for these kids at the same time and doing research that's important to them and improves their disease outcome in the long term.
Gosh, it must be very, very difficult. You talked about availability and accessibility to these services is disproportionate in underrepresented groups, and it's probably even more challenging where you are, Kate. How do you think we can take steps to specifically address that, not only in South Africa, but other underprivileged areas in the world as well?
So I think there needs to be a shift in understanding that, you know, the feedback that we often get is the diseases that are funded in our context are infectious diseases. But we have to acknowledge that chronic illness affects adolescents and young people too and is becoming more and more prevalent in those populations. So services for chronic diseases need to be as good as services for infectious diseases. And research for chronic diseases in our patients also needs to be as good. And it's not because these patients need it just you know, because they're underserved. But I think that there's a real benefit to the global discovery of diseases if we're including people before and after puberty, and if we're including more women in research, and if we're including patients from less resourced areas, because it's just so much more information. And I really think stands to benefit patients everywhere. So, yeah, that's my plug about research, including multiple places. And I think, you know, Kosiana, you're in the same boat as me, that I think lupus can sometimes be an underfunded research area, and adolescence certainly is an underfunded research area. And then I've thrown in a developing country. But I think we almost stand to gain the most ground because we have such an amazing group of people that we serve.
Yeah, absolutely. Love the way you put it, Kate. We need to do that global research to be open to every single population, to be able to do research that represents the reality of the disease in every kind of a social, geographical, economic context. I think this is extremely, extremely important. I think also for us, even if we are better funded and even if probably the investment in chronic diseases in the UK is a little bit better, I still feel that involving young people in what we do, in our service development evaluation, what they want to do, how they want to be involved in different stages of our research, what they consider our research priorities, is something that for me is really a priority, because I learned from them so much, from interacting with young people in clinics, by talking to their parents, to their families, to their siblings, what's really important to them, whatever they struggle with. I think this is a way of kind of trying to address anything that disproportionately affect underrepresented groups.
And something you mentioned about building in the patient voice to research and shaping clinical services. You, of course, do that ad hoc when you see patients in clinic, speaking to them and their parents. But is there any formal way to do this to make sure the patient voice is heard?
Yeah, absolutely, Pooja. We have quite a lot of expertise, and Kate was part of some of the initiatives when she was working with us throughout her PhD of so-called patient groups, or PPIE, patient involvement and engagement, patient and public involvement and engagement activities, where we bring our ideas of research, our plans for changing and restructuring clinical services for discussion with them. And the way we do it is sometimes structured. We have certain questions, certain surveys that we can disseminate to our patient groups, and we've done a lot of disseminations through social media as well to be able to capture national and international communities of patients with a certain disease. But also we've done it in a less structured way, kind of a more qualitative research, to get those themes, those ideas from interacting with patients. We are doing this pretty much every 2 to 3 months, because we are running so many research projects, and especially when we restructure services, the patient's voice is really important.
Now, perhaps we could end on the big picture for the future. If there were no barriers at all in your ideal world, what is your ideal model of working, and how do you think we could achieve it?
Yeah, I mean, so an ideal model, I really like the model that I think it's Janet McDonough writes about in one of her reviews, where you have three phases of transition. You have a kind of early preparatory phase. It starts really young in your 11 or 12-year-olds, where you start to build up resilience, start to teach them some skills, start to talk about things leading up to the transition event. And I also really like the young adult clinic model, where these, you know, we know that 21-year-olds don't have the same capacity for healthcare access and advocacy as a 31-year-old. You know, so I think that it's really valuable to still have a service that is conscious of who they are at up until the age of 25. You know, so my ultimate picture would be a really nice transition model that goes all the way up into young adulthood, and equally is associated with really strong research, so that we, you know, we capture all kinds of important information from these young people, including what they think and what they want and what they need and their experiences, but also looking at the biology of that transition and how disease changes, and following these people up as we go. So, yeah, that, that would be my ultimate vision, and to have that adequately staffed and resourced.
Yeah, absolutely. I quite like Kate's idea. And for me, again, along the same lines, I think for me a transition service should be designed by young people, and young people in every specialty, because their needs are different. And we need to kind of promote their confidence in managing their health. That would be, for me, an ideal model of working. Of course, we discuss about skill training, health literacy, education, how to tackle and deal with behaviors and all those things. But I think if we can get the voice of the young people heard, this is something that will help us shaping services in a way that can address their needs. How can I achieve it as a personal level? Maybe I will need a little bit more time with young people at the time of transition. Maybe I will need a little bit more time to talk to their families, understand what's going on, and also to be able to revisit that. Maybe we should invest a little bit more in educating our patients and families, and better research to identify areas of improvement. And this is not only for understanding the diseases, but understanding what is particular about these diseases at the time of adolescence. I think it's really, I would probably value at the end of every single consultation, I'm not doing this, especially for the transition clinics, to have those few moments with the patient to embed strategies to evaluate how the transition clinic appointment was for them, to get their feedback at the end of every single consultation and build up on that.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's been a fascinating discussion today. We've talked about the importance of transition medicine, the barriers, why we need to move forward, the research priorities and what we can do. And I've learned a huge amount. I'm sure our viewers have found it fascinating as well. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your time and your expertise. And hopefully we can move forward with improving transition and adolescent care around the world. And to our viewers, I just encourage you please to tune in for next month's episode as well, and to continue to support the Lancet Rheumatology Clinical Realities podcast. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Pooja, for having us.